Hello there, everyone. This is Elise Benin of marketing-mentor.com. I am also the co-founder of the Creative Freelancer Conference. And I've been working quite a bit lately with Ed Gandia on some of his material and programs. And this podcast with Jim Gorman, who I will introduce or allow himself to introduce to you momentarily. This podcast is for a program about selling your services and my part in it that has to do with proposals and how to write winning proposals that get you the work that you want. Because I do find that a lot of creative freelancers either don't go after work that requires a proposal because they don't have one or don't want to do it, I suppose. And then others have one simple proposal that they've come up with themselves, maybe never seen anyone else's proposal. That's why I created the proposal bundles in the first place. And don't know how to create one that is tailored to the prospect and the project and what all the elements are. So Jim Gorman has very generously shared with us and you three of his proposals, and we're going to talk a little bit about his business first and the 2.5 years that he has been a full-time self-employed person and what his goals have been and the role that proposals have played in that. And then we're going to look more closely at some of these proposals, and he'll kind of talk us through some of the elements and the thinking behind the elements. So with that little preamble, Jim, please introduce yourself.
Hi, well, I have a company called Gorman 360 that specializes, actually exclusively does advertising for the aviation industry, for aircraft manufacturers, for aftermarket suppliers, for service suppliers, and not airlines, but little airplanes, what we call general aviation, ranging from the little Cessnas and Piper Cubs up to the $50 million Gulfstream business aircraft.
Beautiful. And let's talk a little bit first about how you got here, what your goals were, what your background is, because you bring many, many years of experience and freelancing on the side to this place of being able to, after 2.5 years as a full-time freelancer, be focused exclusively on a target market. So talk about that evolution.
Well, I spent over 30 years working for big advertising agencies, starting as a copywriter, creative director, finally executive creative director at Campbell Ewald Advertising in Detroit, where I was responsible for the Chevy account, Chevy Cars and Trucks, Like a Rock, an American Revolution, all of those kinds of things, none of which I invented, by the way, but all of which I shepherded for many years. And then the United States Postal Service was another client. So the very substantial size clients for all those years. But along the way, I have been an airplane nut since I was 2 years old. I had an uncle who was a fighter pilot who was my hero when I was a kid. And so I have been a pilot for over 20 years. I've owned my own little airplane. And I had this, actually I won't call it a fantasy because it was always something that I felt I could do, but in the back of my mind, I had this plan that once I retired from the big agency, that I would do aviation advertising, combining my experience as a creative and marketing person, a strategic planning person, with my love of airplanes. And so for probably 10 years, as I got older, and I won't write it all off to age, but when I was 50 years old, I used to say that when you're 50 in an advertising agency and when you're 50 in a creative department, you're an old man. I began to see the end of that career coming kind of like a slow-moving freight train as the agency was putting more and more effort into finding younger talent. They will never admit it's age-based, but all of us who have been in advertising know that's a big part of it, both to communicate with other young people and because it's difficult to stay fresh after you've been doing it all those years and have ideas that are contemporary and to have the kind of enthusiasm you had when you were 25. So for, probably 10 years, I started turning my attention to figuring out what I was going to do when that ended. And I used every single opportunity I had. Every vacation, I would be at an aviation trade show. I'd be meeting people. I would be getting freelance opportunities. And so for 10 years, I found myself working two jobs, literally. It eventually got to the point where it literally was two jobs. I would get up every single morning. I'd stop at a coffee shop on my way to the office. I'd write my freelance aviation stuff. I'd go to work at Campbell Leewald. I would creative direct the stuff for Chevy or the U.S. Postal Service. I'd come home at night. I'd write my aviation stuff at night and on the weekends. And then about 2 years ago, I had what I will call in quotes the opportunity to retire, which is to say they said you're retiring. And by that time, I was very eager to do that and to start doing this for a living. And probably 2 weeks later, my website was up. I already had a couple of accounts that I'd been working with for several years. And I was able to use that opportunity to reach out to all of the contacts that I made and the accounts that I had and say, okay, I'm doing this full time now. Let's go. Let's get serious. And it's been great ever since.
And that was 2.5 years ago, and that's when we originally met. And I know you have consulted with all different types of people who have guided you, which I think is a really important point, actually, because so many individuals, especially if you are offered the opportunity to retire, or even if you, dive out into this freelance world on your own, I think not enough people put enough time and effort into building their network and getting the questions answered that they have. And so it seems to me very smart that you were setting the foundation for 10 years in the first place, and then kind of gathered about you all of these people who could help you that you trusted.
Well, it's key. There are a lot of advantages to being in business by yourself, and I am a one person marketing consultant, though I have some very strong team members that I've met and worked with over the years who now work with me on things. But I'm what Elise likes to call a solopreneur, and that's a big difference from working in an ad agency where you have not just all sorts of support, but where you're around other people who are expert in areas where you're not. So I was able to, in the ad agency, I was able to insinuate myself into projects that involve social media. And I did that not because that was part of my responsibility, but because I wanted to soak up whatever I could learn about social media or digital or research. And you don't have any of those things when you're on your own. Actually, you and I at least started working together before I left the ad agency. Hmm. And there are certain... Now that you've given me this opportunity to talk to other people who are doing similar things, there are certain things that I would love to be able to tell people who are in situations that I think many of us find ourselves in when we're working for other people and working for ad agencies. Don't wait until you get whacked to figure out what you're going to do next. I think it is highly unusual. If you're going to be honest with yourself, it is highly unusual not to see all sorts of signs that things are changing at the ad agency. An account's in trouble. You know that if they lose that account, they can't pay your salary. You see other people coming into the agency, and all of a sudden you've got a different boss. I haven't seen a lot of situations where people should have been blindsided, but I've seen a whole lot of situations where they were. Right. And so I did start working on this actively before then. And Elise, you were kind of one of the last links in the chain before I went out on my own. I started talking with you about my my website, right, and the name of the company. And at the time, there was a question mark of whether I could make it on my own, purely focusing on aviation advertising, or whether I would have to supplement that with general advertising. You and I discussed that a lot. We discussed the name of the company and keeping the name sort of general enough that it wouldn't communicate that I only did aviation advertising. The website was one thing where you were very helpful with some constructive criticism and the "what's in it for me" school of thought, because it's very difficult for those of us who have been marketing people, creative directors, people in charge of other people's brand images. It's very difficult for us when all of a sudden we're in charge of our own brand image. It's difficult for us to practice what we preached all those years. Be single-minded, talk about the benefit, not the process, make sure your market knows what it is you do for them, and then all of a sudden you're on your own and everything goes out the window because you keep thinking, no, I've got too many important things to say. So it becomes very important to have some sort of counsel you can trust, somebody who will tell you when your baby's ugly. That's a really important thing.
And go back then to that question about whether or not there seemed to be or is enough work in the aviation industry for you to focus exclusively on that.
Well, I'd received some counsel from a lot of people that I really trusted who were involved in aviation advertising, not from the standpoint of being an ad agency that specialized in it, but people who were in magazines and other areas of it, who said to me, there's just not that much money out here. There are not that many companies doing it. And ironic though it may seem, when you think that somebody's selling a business jet for $30 or $40 million, you'd think that the companies ought to be equally wealthy, and they're not. The majority of businesses that I've met are kind of living hand to mouth, and to them, an expenditure on marketing of any sort is a cost they really don't want to deal with, because they're trying to put all of their money into developing new airplanes and that sort of thing. So I received what was good counsel, that it's going to be tough to get a lot of business. However, what I found is I don't need a lot of business. That is an advantage of being a solopreneur. I don't have a staff of 5, 10, 20 people that I have to support. It's just me. My business model of developing strong partnerships, and I call them partnerships, they are freelance people, but I treat all of those freelance people as partners. I want them to make me better and make the work better and all those things that they do well that I don't. I just didn't need that much work. And then also, I can't handle that much work. I'm at a point where I either have to start hiring people, which I don't want to do for a variety of reasons, or I have to be at a point where I am very selective about what business I take on. And that has been a pattern of mine, not since the beginning, because when I started out, it was like everybody starts off desperate and scared, thinking that you don't know where your next meal is going to come from. And, oh my God, if you pass up this opportunity, another one's never going to come along. So you've got to take it at all costs. And then you do get to a point where you realize you can't take every opportunity. And all of those things that you believe intuitively are really true. Like, for instance, it takes every bit as much work to work for a little client without a lot of money as it does to work for a bigger client with a larger budget. So you have to start becoming more critical about the work you take on. So that's where I'm at now. I have room for one more quality retainer client.
Right. And so just describe, before we go into the proposals, the scope, the your plate, basically. You have four retainer clients, and you're saying you have room for one more quality retainer clients. And I think that people are very interested and should be in the idea of retainer clients, because obviously that gives you a foundation, that gives you bread and butter, that tells you where your next meal is coming from. But frankly, for some reason, I don't see too many people pursuing that type of relationship. So, and I know that yours didn't start that way. So talk a little bit about that.
They don't pursue it, or they don't seem to be successful in getting retainer clients?
Most people don't actually pursue it.
Well, I have a lot of advantages, things that I've been very fortunate to have, skill sets that I've been fortunate to acquire over the years working with advertising agencies. Most of the ad agencies I work for are very big national or multinational agencies that have hundreds or thousands of people working there. And as part of that, of course, they have people who know a lot about new business. And in one of the things you realize in those ad agencies, even smaller ad agencies, is virtually all of their clients are ongoing relationships. There are sometimes they're working on a project basis for a client, but it's rare. So if you're working on a project, you're a hired gun. You come in, you're sort of an order taker. Here's the project. We need a logo. We need a series of print ads. We need a website. How much will it cost? How much per hour are you going to charge me to do it? I don't want to pay that much. Here's how much I'll pay. Okay, nice job. Thanks very much. Got to go. And then you're on to trying to find your next meal or trying to find where your next project is coming from. Whereas if you're on a retainer, yes, the advantage to you financially is that you have some sort of predictability of where your income is coming from. And that's a great thing because it takes some of the pressure off. You're never I don't have any contracts, by the way, that will pay me if a client fires me, that'll pay me beyond 30 days. I do know people who do that. So there's not a lot of stability there. That, gee, I'm going to have income for the next year, even if I don't do any work for this client. But it's knowing that it gives you an opportunity, just like working at an ad agency, it gives you an opportunity to become very familiar with a client, both in a business sense and in a personal sense. I'm on the phone with my clients frequently. I get to know them. They get to know me. They treat me like part of the team. And when they do that, then the more you can get inside the head of your client to understand what their long-range goals are, sometimes to understand the politics and their problems they're facing internally, it makes you then a bigger part of the solution. Now, all of a sudden, you're not just taking orders. Now you have the ability to say, you know, I've been thinking about an idea. Suppose we try this next month or this or next quarter. Or next year when you're going to be doing your budget for 2014, I know you can't afford it now, let's try it next year. And so that becomes a very, very positive relationship for everybody. So I try to pursue that.
And I think that that is also very smart, because with the direction that the economy is taking and the world of creative services, where many of the deliverables that writers and designers produce are becoming commoditized and the prices are going down, down, down. Really, what you have to do to survive is, you know, sell your brain, sell your thought process, sell your relationship with them, and position yourself as more of a consultant than a doer, a thinker as opposed to a doer. And it sounds like the retainer arrangement puts you in a position to learn what you need in order to provide that value.
Well, I agree with that, and I also agree with positioning yourself as a consultant, not just a designer, not just a writer, because with apologies to all my creative brethren, writers and designers, art directors are a dime a dozen, almost literally a dime a dozen. It will actually make you nauseous to think about how little some people charge to do ostensibly the same job you do. It's not going to be as good as the job you do, but if you have a client that's not very sophisticated, that client may not know that. One of the things that we're all fighting against these days, especially art directors and designers, is that many, many clients have people on staff who call themselves designers because they can manipulate InDesign or they can manipulate Photoshop. And an unsophisticated advertiser can't tell the difference. And they don't see why they should pay an outside resource what to them is a lot of money when they've got somebody who's on staff who they think can do the same thing. That person can do a print, that person can do a brochure for me. Why do I need you? So I do think that you have to elevate yourself above that. And that was a key piece of advice I got early on in this, was to stop selling myself as a writer, stop selling myself as a creative director. I call myself a marketing consultant. And as a matter of fact, not only do I call myself a marketing consultant, but I celebrate the idea that I don't have a staff and that I'm not an advertising agency. My little three-story elevator pitch is that I say I'm a marketing consultant, strategic planner, and creative resource specializing in working with aviation-related businesses who don't want, don't need, can't afford, or have had a bad experience with an advertising agency that doesn't understand their business. And I say, look, you're not paying for overhead. You're not paying for admins, and you're not paying for coffee machines, and you're not paying for all of that stuff with me. You're paying for my brain. And after all, that's what you really need in a marketing partner, is a brain. An advertising agency is nothing more than a collection of brains and experiences. So I'm here for you. And then when we need expertise that I cannot provide, I don't try to be all things to all clients. I say I do what I do well, and I know my strengths, I know my weaknesses. And whenever I encounter a weakness or I encounter something that I don't do well, I have a team of really, really good people, people who are way better at what they do than I am at what they do. I bring them in on sort of an a la carte buffet of big agency thinking. A lot of them are refugees from big agencies like me. You pay them for the project, and then they go away. So I'm the one on retainer. Whether or not my partners can work on a retainer is sort of their issue. I do have one partner that is not on a retainer with me, but she has become such an important part of one of my clients' business. She is close to being on a retainer with the client, mm-hmm. to be a designer and art director with a client.
Good. So, okay, let's move to the proposals, because I want to make sure we have time to look closely at them. And you have very generously shared three proposals. One is the first one is a 13-page proposal for a startup. The second one is a 35-page, much more involved campaign for one of your retainer clients. And the third is a short proposal for, I believe, an existing client. So I want to just talk in detail maybe about one or two of them, and then a little overview of which one is good for which type of situation. So let's start with that first one.
Okay. Here's what I really believe is key to writing proposals. And that is, before you spend 1 minute writing it, you understand the end game. And the end game is to convince a client who, in most cases, doesn't know you, and is to one degree or another going to be taking a chance on you, to convince that client that you're the right person or the right company for the job. And in order to do that, this is your opportunity, your only opportunity, to make a great first impression. And that great first impression has to be a few things rolled into one. First of all, it is your opportunity to tell the client that you care enough about them that you're not creating some sort of a boilerplate prefab presentation where you could just take their name out and plug in somebody else's name. That was one of the And one of the things you taught me early on, at least, that I think is extremely important. I do have a lot of elements of presentations that I will copy and paste from one to the other. But I always start off with a personal letter from me to that client, telling the client it's my opportunity to brag about my big agency background. It's my opportunity to brag about my aviation background. And so in that one letter, to build a set of logic which makes that client feel he'd be an absolute idiot if he didn't hire Gorman 360 to work with him. And then from then on, I try very hard to only pick those elements that relate to his or her specific assignment. I try to answer that assignment precisely. If the client has said, I need a logo redesign, I need a website, and that's all I need from you, then those are the team members that I'm going to bring into it, and that's the way I'm going to approach the proposal. Okay, we're going to design a logo for you. We're going to design a website for you. Now, as part of that website, we're going to do search engine optimization, because that's an integral part of the website. That's what you've asked for. That's what I'm doing. And then at that point, I'll take that opportunity then to say, but you know, there's a lot more we could do to make your business a success that you haven't asked for. And so on top of what you did ask for and on top of what I'm going to deliver, let me make some suggestions as we move forward. The other part of writing a proposal I think is crucial is something that I feel lucky that I just sort of knew intuitively from the first time I ever wrote a cover letter or a resume to a creative director for my first job as a junior writer in an ad agency. I knew that as a writer, anything that I put down in black and white, anything that I wrote, was going to be signaling to that creative director what kind of a writer I am. If I use bad grammar, he's going to think I don't know good grammar. If I write it like I just came out of a business school and use that kind of very business-like construction, he's going to think that I don't know how to talk to people on a colloquial level. If I'm not creative in it, he's going to think I'm not a creative person. If I'm not funny, he's going to think I'm not a funny person. And so I've always used that approach whenever I'm communicating with clients. And I got to tell you, over the years of being a creative director, I have been stunned at how few writers and art directors seems to get that. I'm sure that I have received hundreds and hundreds of resumes, letters, portfolios from people over the years. And back when people were writing cover letters, and I still think that's crucial for a creative person, I would, in the first paragraph of that letter, I kind of made up my mind if that person is not somebody I want to work with. I not necessarily have made up my mind if it is somebody I want to work with, but I can tell from just the way they wrote that letter, boy, this person just doesn't get it. It's not somebody I want on the team. And I think that is equally important when you're doing proposals, especially for something like what I'm doing and what I think a lot of people, whether it's a writer or a designer, does. It's not just you, it's your overall approach.
And speaking of your overall approach, on page 7, you go into detail about your process. Talk a little bit about that.
I want them to understand why we charge the kind of money we charge. I guess that's probably the simplest way to put it. And so if what they've asked for is a logo, is a new brand image, I want them to understand that it's not simply a matter of a designer sitting down in front of a computer screen and sort of farting out 30 or 40 logos and they pick one, that there's a lot of thought that goes into it. And I want them to understand that we're going to start off every single project by giving them an estimate so they know how much it's going to cost them, so there are no nasty surprises up front. We are going to have a discovery process, which is generally going to entail me learning as much about the client as I possibly can. whether it is for the client or for my team members, I always write a creative brief. I hand the creative brief to the client. I want the client to say, yeah, that's exactly what we agreed to, because it saves a lot of wheel spinning later on. It sets the groundwork so that when the client is looking at the work you do, the client then is going to judge it based on that creative brief. And if they don't, then you haul out the creative brief and say, yeah, well, you know, that's not what we talked about here.
And you even include a link to an example of a creative brief in your proposal.
Right, right. Because I deal with a lot of clients who are not very sophisticated advertisers. Any client that's dealt with an advertising agency knows about creative briefs. But if it's somebody, if you're their first exposure to professional marketing, design, copywriting, they may never have seen a creative brief before. So I want them to understand why I do what I do.
Okay, so we are looking at your proposal, and I wanted to look next at the page, I think it's page 9, where you estimate costs. And here I noticed that you have itemized, like a Chinese menu, a whole bunch of these costs, which I know you don't always do. So talk to us about how to put costs and pricing in this type of proposal and why you did it this way here.
Well, no, I don't always itemize to this level of granularity. I try not to, as a matter of fact, because it's kind of, you know, the old cliche of sometimes you don't need to know how the hot dogs are made. In this case, though, it was a startup. He's never had any experience dealing with an advertising agency or design firm. He asked for some specific things, so I wanted him to understand what those things cost. And at the same time, I didn't just provide costs, but I explained what went into them, sort of trying to make him understand how much work went into each one. I try very hard not to charge by the hour. I think that's a losing proposition for everyone. For clients, either they tend to be looking over your shoulder and wondering how many hours you're put into something, or they start dissecting the total cost you want by the number of hours that they see you're going to put into it and think, holy moly, I can't believe I'm paying that person so much per hour. And I find that if I provide a fixed cost for something, a flat rate, I estimate it by the number of hours it's going to take and how much I want to make per hour, how much my team wants to make per hour. I know that information. My team knows then how many hours they should predict to go into it, but we try not to get into that with the client.
And I often say it's none of the client's business what the hourly rate is or how long it actually takes. But I know that there are sometimes clients who insist, or even some situations where you're required in a proposal or an RFP, to put an hourly rate.
Well, and clients are trained that way through years of working with advertising agencies, too. Most ad agencies have an hourly rate. They have several hourly rates, depending on whether you're they will have a different rate for a junior writer, senior writer, junior art director, creative director, executive creative director, account person. And so if you have a client that is experienced working with an ad agency, that's what they're used to. And there, I do have a number of clients that want some idea of how much they're paying per hour.
Mm-hmm. And I do think I appreciate the fact that, you know, it's based on history and essentially people like us training them in that direction. And to me, that means we have to untrain them and, you know, kind of educate them, if you will, about why working with someone like you, who, as you said earlier, doesn't have all the overhead, you know, doesn't have all the expenses, it's just another benefit to know exactly how much something is going to cost, the fixed rate, as you say. And I think the important point here in this proposal is, as you said, you are giving them as much detail as you can about what actually goes into each of these projects or elements so that they can value it, basically. Because otherwise, if it were just, you know, a one-liner with a number, they wouldn't value it.
And I do try to explain to them what I really believe the benefit is to them as well as to my people or me, and that is no nasty surprises. Mm-hmm. If they know what they're going to pay up front, if we end up putting more hours than we have projected, then it's our problem. If we end up putting less hours than we projected, then it's to our benefit, but then I'm not required at that point to give them a rebate. After all, it should, in theory, be priced on what it's worth, right. Not you know, because a great example is a theme line. It is entirely possible to come up with a theme line in half an hour, or it's entirely possible that it could take a week to come up with a theme line. And that is something that should be an extremely valuable thing to a client that believes it's important. That's going to appear on all of their work for months or years to come. So I don't think that ought to be worth $150 just because you did it in an hour.
Agreed. So let's move on then to page 11, where you have a lot of white space on this page, which is titled Terms and Conditions. Explain that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of white space. White space is not a bad thing.
I know.
I don't put contracts in my proposal. I learned a great contract. I don't know if remember if it was from you or one of the people in one of our groups, but it's Freelancers Union.
Yep.
Has a good template for a contract. I think it's overly complicated and they're a little bit onerous in some situations. But I just want them to know, here's how I work. Before we start, we're going to sign a contract. And in this case, I wanted him to understand that because I had to pay some of my people in order to get them to do work, we needed a third of it up front, a third when we saw the presentation, and then a third upon completion of the project. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten burned doing that too, because I did a website for somebody that I had predicted would take, and I was just writing the website. I was not in charge of developing it. And I thought it would take 3 months. Well, because of some things that happened with the developer, which was hired by the client, it took over a year.
Right.
So I didn't get paid the final third until a year later.
And this could be a whole other webinar, but I'll just say that my recommendation, especially when it comes to interactive work, which does end up taking twice as long always and getting more complicated and changing more than anything printed would, my recommendation is that you don't tie the payment process or the structure to the milestones in the project, that you do it based on time. And, you know, if they're paying a certain amount per month over the course of the 5 months you have estimated it's going to take, and they finish paying after 5 months and you're still not finished, then they will have more incentive to go through and finish the process.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't want to get into too much of that, but I just wanted to kind of note it for people who can experiment with that. I've seen people do it. It works. It doesn't work with everybody. Not everyone is agreeable to it, but it's definitely worth presenting as your payment structure and see how people respond. Let's look at page 12, which is about the timing, which I think is a really, really important aspect of a proposal that most people I see don't put enough time into. And you have done something very simple here by doing both text and visuals to show exactly what the time frame is that you project. So talk us through that a little bit.
Well, the visuals were the idea of my design partner, which is one more reason why I think it's so important for someone who is not graphically oriented, as I am not, to have a designer contribute to a proposal and to add some visual interest to it. We wanted to do a couple of things here. One was to give them an approximate timeline. And of course, that can slip very easily, and a lot of that depends on how long it's going to take a client to approve a phase. But to say, okay, this is going to take 2 weeks, this will take 1 week, this will take 3 weeks, and then I put an approximate client review date here so that in this case, I would sort of prompt some sort of action for this not to lay fallow for weeks or months, but to say, okay, today I don't remember whatever date I submitted this, but this assumes we're going to start August 15th. And if we do that, you'll get this phase on the 29th, this phase on September 12th, et cetera, et cetera.
And I think this just makes you look also as professional and together and organized as you are, and kind of goes against and flies in the face of, if you will, the flakiness that precedes so many creative professionals. So just really adds to why someone would want to work with you. All right. And my favorite part of this first proposal is the last page, where you go over and above what they've asked you for here and provided what you call thoughts on additional marketing elements. Tell us about that.
Well, that's something that I always try to do. I have learned over the years, when somebody asks you a question, the first thing you do is answer the question. And you try to answer it directly and without a lot of confusion and beating around the bush. But then, especially in the case of a proposal, once you've answered the question, then you go beyond that question to give them ideas that they can do in the future. And I do that for a couple of reasons. One is I want them to work more with me than what they have asked for. Secondly, I want them to know we're capable of a lot more. And then thirdly, a lot of the ideas on this proposal and other proposals don't come from me, but they come from my partners, people who think of things that I don't, because somebody may work in digital more than I do, social media, that sort of thing. Hey, you didn't ask for social media, but you know, we're capable of doing it, and it's a great thing to add to it.
Absolutely. And I love especially the aspect of, you know, here's what else we can do for you, because clients don't always know what they need. Even if they think they know what they need, there's a lot they don't know that they don't know. And so this really addresses that issue. And I love the way you do that. Okay. So let's look next at the second proposal, which is a much longer proposal, 35 pages, and more recent, I understand. And obviously, we can't go page to page on this one, but let's just highlight a few things here. Maybe the first question you can answer, Jim, is, you know, what was this situation? Why did you do 35 pages? And what's different about this one than the other one?
Well, this is a client that in some ways actually had a more defined scope of work, but in other ways was looking for, and in their RFP, which was a very vague, short, general RFP, but in their RFP, they were looking for a partner that would be a year-long contract. So I knew going into it that this wasn't just a one-off, but something that had the not only the potential but the desire on the part of the client to have more of sort of a traditional advertising agency relationship. So I was going to propose a retainer. I was going to, again, answer the question the client asked, which is, how am I going to rebrand myself? How am I going to do a new website? How am I going to do a blog that we're going to distribute? And then really to try to give them a lot more ideas beyond that that he hadn't thought of, because, again, it was another client that had not had a lot of experience working with ad agencies, and so was pretty unsophisticated in it. That's and we had a lot more people involved, so I guess that's why we went overboard on this.
And so are there aspects of it or elements of it that you think are especially useful that you would highlight for people approaching a similar type of situation, which is basically a very large, long project, a campaign of some sort, where, you know, they think they know what they need, but it's definitely going to change. So you have to estimate based on some parameters that are going to need some cushion in there.
Well, one of the things that I think is real important, and I may have said this before, is something that I've learned from you, which is when you have an RFP, when you have something written out from the client, use that as a template for the proposal. and not only as a template, but make sure that throughout the proposal, you're writing the proposal in the same order as that RFP, because you need to assume that the client put some thought into how their requests were ordered, whether it was by time or by what was more important to them. And so I will take the actual language from the RFP, and I will use that in the proposal. Here's what you asked for, verbatim. Here's what I'm proposing. So we did that here. I think that works very well. It makes the client understand that you're paying attention to them, that you're hearing what they say, and that you're putting a lot of thought into answering what they've asked for.
You know, the other thing, two thoughts actually about this, is that you have done a lot of the pages are taken up with examples of work from your portfolio. And also, you've actually done some of the thinking. You're making recommendations here. Where is the line between doing what people call spec work that you're not going to get paid for, or giving your ideas away, and, you know, what is appropriate to do when you really want the job?
I think almost always you have to show them creative. Almost always. It's been my experience from working in ad agencies. It is rare that an ad agency will go into a new business pitch and not show the client spec creative, mm-hmm. first of all. It's a lot more difficult to do that when you're a freelancer and you have limited resources and you don't have a staff that is on salary. So in that case, I'm either imposing upon all of my partners to take a chance with me and to do spec work on their part, or in this case, I really didn't want to do a lot of spec work, but I wanted them to understand the proficiency and the experience that we were going to bring to it. So the way of doing that then, without showing them, for example, they wanted logos. I don't want to show somebody a bunch of logos that we're doing for them, because it's too easy for them to run off with those. But I wanted them to know the proficiency that my design partner has. So we included a number of logos that she had done for some pretty big companies. We did do some examples that we had done for other clients. And I think these fell into the above and beyond your scope of services category of remarketing. Again, didn't want to do that stuff for them, but we had been pretty successful. Some other clients will use that. We did do an outline of the website. Not exactly a wireframe, but to show them that we had put some thought into that website. And I find that clients really appreciate in a new business pitch or in a proposal, which is the same thing in this case, that you care enough about them and you put enough effort into it to think about some solutions that they asked you for. It was kind of, in some cases, it was difficult here when we got into the website. We didn't really have any examples of websites that we had done from the ground up, design them and write them. I had written some websites on my own. My design partner had never designed a website. My web developer partner had developed a lot of sites he hadn't designed. So we had all of the parts. We didn't have everything together. So that's another reason why we included some examples of things they had done.
And actually, I think that is a good situation when the portfolio pieces that you have to show don't really make sense for what you're trying to pitch, that the alternative of, all right, let us show you what we would do for you then, is much more relevant to them anyway.
Right.
Okay, great. And then let's just look at the last page of this very long and well-written proposal, because you do something a little different on this one, which is next steps and timing. So talk a little bit about that, because I think it's really important to tell them exactly what the next steps would be from your point of view. Again, that shows how professional you are. We've done this over and over. Here's our process. So what's the thinking behind yours?
Well, it's follows the same logic that we talked about in the other one. to say, here's how we're going to proceed. First of all, we're going to sign a mutually agreeable agreement, a mutually acceptable agreement. And then what I want to do after that is I want to really dive into your company and learn as much about it as I can, because I wanted him to understand that one of the things that I bring to this, along with what my partners bring to it, is I do a lot of strategic thinking that really involves trying to learn as much about the needs and hopes and wants and fears of the client as I possibly can. I wanted him to understand that I do work on a retainer in this case. And as part of that, here's what I'm going to expect from you. And then here's what my other folks will expect from you as we move forward.
Beautiful. And then I love timing, : we're ready to go whenever you are. Just, you know, the enthusiasm of that.
Well, it's the ask for the order.
Exactly, which is where a lot of people just fall down, in my opinion. Okay, beautiful. All right, let's close that one and look at the third one, which I find very interesting. And so talk us through, Jim, what this third proposal is, because I haven't really ever seen anything like it, and I think it's a really good model. So explain how it came about and what exactly it is.
Well, this is a much smaller project, and it did not set out to be an ongoing project from the client's point of view. It's a very small company that is living hand to mouth. It's a company that I had been stalking for some time at various trade shows, probably 3 or 4 years, maybe even more than that. I would always go up to the client at a trade show, and it happens to be a product that I use and believe in, so would start the conversation that way. So I didn't feel that a lot of that other, you know, sort of background stuff and the things that go involved in trying to sell myself to that point were really that important. He had here a very specific set of things he wanted to do in the short term. And again, I'm always thinking, I don't want to do short-term projects. I want them to be long-term. I want them to be ongoing forever. So this was one that I tried to construct to, again, answer the question he asked, which is, what are you going to do for me now? But then take that and say, however, this is just the beginning. There's a lot more than we can do. That's why we put it in terms of this now, soon, and later construct. This is what we're going to do immediately. Then in the next 6 months, if you like what we've done now, here's how we're going to roll that out. And then in the future, once you feel that this is successful and it's been worthwhile for you from an investment standpoint, later, here's how we can make it really mean something. And then the other thing that I added to this, which is actually a little bit out of order here, is always, now, soon, later, and always, because always in this case involves something the client is not doing at all. Their messaging is very unfocused. It's very complex. And in this case, the client's pricing was probably his biggest drawback, because he had gotten into a pattern of always doing bargain basement cut rate sales day in and day out. It's like you go to the website, there are 6 different ways to price the same thing, and you always feel like you're going to get screwed if you're not real careful in buying it on the right time. So that's why we started with always. Focus on the target. You got to have a much simpler message than you do. The process is just not as complicated as you make it seem on the website, and we've got to get out of these pricing gimmicks and back to offering quality over price. So that's what this was.
And you know what I love about this? This is a 5-page document, 2 of which are examples of your work. So 2 pages, which is essentially the proposal, but is actually like I see it as not a marketing plan per se, because that would be much more complex and involved, but this is like two pages of what you must be doing that I will help you with. And then the last page is the pricing.
Right. And I think I included the work that I did, which was just one example, because it was a direct mail piece for another company with a very, very limited budget, to say you don't have to spend an arm and a leg to do something that communicates a lot of information and can be pretty effective.
Mm-hmm. And if I recall correctly, you were very recently going to present this or hear from your prospect about this?
Yep, and he hired us. And primarily, we actually didn't do any of the direct mail. It was all digital. We did a pay-per-click campaign. We did some display ads. We did this remarketing, which clients just find magic. It's a very insidious way to use information you get from somebody who's visited the website and to use that information to follow them around the internet for the next month or so, and then serve up display advertising in places where they least expect it. But it works like crazy, and it is a pretty good way to brand a company for very little money.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. It worked very well. We served it up again as a 3-month test, and then we got another 3 months out of it. And actually, after that second 3 months, have not heard back from them.
Mm-hmm.
they thought it was successful, but you know, it's all money. It all comes down to money, and this is a client that is every month sort of concerned that they're not going to be able to keep the doors open next month.
Right. And do you think you'll use this format again?
Sure. Yeah, one of the things that I have learned is not to reinvent the wheel every time, but to take what works and adapt those for similar situations, but making sure that you customize those things that need to be customized.
Mm-hmm. So let's just begin to wrap up here a little bit, Jim. And one of the questions I have for you has to do with kind of the attitude with which you approach these things. And, you know, it could be thanks to your age and wisdom that you aren't intimidated, or, you know, that you come right out and say, I'm stalking this prospect, because I feel like a lot of people are afraid of being perceived as stalkers, and you seem to not care. So just talk a little bit about that approach and maybe even how it affects your proposals.
Well, I mean, actually, that's not true. I care a great deal. I think one of the things you said to me early on was that sometimes we're told by our mother never to brag about ourselves.
Right.
And I think most creative people are torn between that, and we all have these fragile egos, and so we can be perceived as being very egotistical, but we're very uneasy at being so egotistical, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when I say I care a great deal, I don't like to be stalked by a salesperson. And so I assume the clients feel the same way. So I'm always, I refer to it as stalking, because, you know, I'm sort of taking weeks or months to try to get a client to feel comfortable enough with me that they want to give me a chance. And I do think that there is a fine line there between being persistent and showing that you're interested and just driving them crazy. And I've been in that situation too, where a client thought that I was too aggressive, and they felt cornered and they backed off. I don't know what the fine line is there, Elise.
Mm-hmm. I think it's case by case, and I think that people will tell you when you're being too aggressive. And my experience with most creative professionals is that they stay as far away from that line as they can possibly stay, and as a result, miss out on a lot of opportunities. And I personally think that it's worth pushing further because of what you could get, as opposed to being cautious and, you know, not even knowing what you could have gotten?
Well, here's the thing. You work with a lot of different kinds of people that have different backgrounds. And some of the people I've met through you are designers who have never worked in an ad agency. They've only worked in design studios. There are people that have had other backgrounds. And I do think that working for ad agencies for so many years sort of gave me all the tools I needed to go out on my own, but I didn't realize it at first. I had to realize that I've always said I'm a lousy salesman because I'm so self-conscious about it. And I had to realize, wait a minute, for 30 some years, I've been a great salesman, but I've been selling other people's products, never my own.
Right.
And so I did start off very tentatively doing cold calls. And for me, the cold calls primarily begin at the trade shows. That is, since my clients are all over the country, and I don't have an unlimited budget to go out and make trips to meet a client one at a time, I tend to meet them face to face for the first time at a trade show. And then I use those trade shows, which are several times a year, to run into the client again and again. I walk up to the booth. I say, hey, how you doing? How are things going? And I find that I've gotten a lot better at those cold calls than I thought I had. Mm-hmm. You have to, we're not good as creative people at rejection. And the difference between us and people who really are salespeople for a living is rejection is part of the business. And I've heard people say that you have to take no 10 times to get one yes. And that's really difficult for creative people. We get one no, and we take it very personally because we throw so much of ourselves into our work, and we feel that we have just been rejected.
And I think that is actually a good place to stop. But I do want to make the point that what you are calling rejection is usually silence, not a direct no. And to me, the silence is not now, and that's when, you know, you keep doing what you were calling stalking, visiting, saying hello, how you doing, you know, reaching out, following up by email, all of those things, because they don't reject you. They just aren't ready to say yes.
That's true.
All right. So I'm going to revise the vocabulary and let's try to reject the word rejection.
Okay. I like that.
All right, Jim, I want to thank you so much. I don't think you realize how generous you're being with your process and your experience and your proposals. And I want to thank you so much for sharing. And let's give people your web address so they can go find out more about you, because who knows, maybe they have an aviation client that they can't help and you're the perfect person for them.
Well, I appreciate that. And thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to do this. And thanks for everything you've done over the 2.5 years or so we've been working together to help me get smarter at my business and making money. And the web address is Gorman360, GORMAN360.com.
Beautiful. All right. And I'm at marketing-mentor.com. And I offer a free half-hour session for anyone who wants to talk about any of this. And you can sign up for my quick tips, and I'm here whenever you need me. So thank you for listening, and we'll be in touch soon. Bye.